Welcome to Mindama, real conversations about what really matters.
Our next guest on the Mindama podcast is Dean Bayliss, a proud Gomeroi man and CEO of Healing Works Australia. Dean and his team are on the front line of suicide prevention among First Nations people, a community where the suicide rate is nearly 2.5 times that of non-Indigenous Australians. Dean brings passion, insight, and humanity to his work. He's guided by his own lived experience of mental illness and an understanding that Indigenous communities are the experts and services need to listen, not lecture them. Healing Works Australia is a 3-year-old Indigenous organisation that provides community healing workshops, suicide prevention consulting, First Nations employee cultural and clinical supervision, and suicide intervention skills training. In recent years, it has focused on supporting communities affected by floods and bushfires. Dean is also a Coalition of Peak Independent Representative for the SEWB Policy Partnership Close the Gap and National Network Member for the Black Dog Institute. Dean is incredibly compassionate and insightful, and there is no doubt he is a man on a mission. I'm delighted that in this episode he speaks to Dean Yates about his journey so far. The two Deans clearly loved chatting to each other. We hope you enjoy the podcast.
We acknowledge the traditional owners and custodians of the land on which this podcast is recorded. We pay our respects to their ancestors, elders, and Aboriginal leaders, past, present, and emerging. Hi, Dean. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Yeah, thanks, brother. Pleasure to be here.
Dean, can you tell me a little bit about where you grew up, what it was like?
First, I'll just like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land that I'm meeting on here today. Dean, I'm on Wiradjuri country in Dubbo, New South Wales. Elders are past, present, and emerging, and the richness of the culture that they bring and for what allowing me to live on their lands. I'm a proud Gomeroi man, mate, which is from the Northwest Slopes and Plains. I grew up in a small country town in the Northwest Slopes and Plains of country New South Wales.
What town was it?
Tamworth, New South Wales, mate. Yeah, grew up in Tamworth. Country music.
Do you like any country music?
I do not. Mate, look, it's pretty good, but it's great for the town, and I spent a lot of years in there, so as I get older, I'm starting to appreciate the music a lot more. I can say that.
Dean, sadly, suicide was part of life growing up in your community, right?
Yeah, it was. I remember that I was about 14, Dean, when I first come across someone who died by suicide in my community, and then a couple of mates, like, at school, and I think we just fobbed it off a little bit, didn't we? Like, people died by suicide in our sporting teams and that, and some good friends, and I had an uncle at 21 that died by suicide. Wasn't very much talked about, though. Sort of, we get talks about it a bit later on in life, but it was just sort of, oh yeah, and Uncle Peter's died. Yeah, so it was pretty prevalent through my school years, through high school, and what that meant.
Your son didn't really talk about much, Dean, in those days, do you think?
No, it wasn't. There's a lot of shame and stigma around suicide, and the fact that if you think you're talking about it, you might actually make someone act on suicide or think about suicide. A lot of families have culled a lot of shame around suicide and what that means of weakness, and we all have our different attitudes around suicide and what it means to us, and I think that can impact communities and families a lot.
What did you do before you started working in mental health?
I was a tradesman from year. I was 15 years old and left school. Left school in year 9. I failed year 10. I went to year 10, but I didn't get through. And I started doing a trade. And I was only 15. I was a year ahead of myself in school. I was quite a big lad, and I played football. I was good at NRL and stuff, and make a bit of a joke. I could lift a ton. I just couldn't spell it. So I went to school and I was there predominantly for sport, and then I become a tradesman, and I just have an attention for detail. So I loved doing my trade. Yeah, I was a tradie. Yes. And then from there, I ended up buying some businesses. I was a tradesman. I did pretty well. Ended up buying some businesses in retail, and moved to Newcastle, New South Wales with my family in 2006. And I did quite well with businesses, and I bought a business, then I bought another business, and we're doing okay. Yeah.
Are you a Newcastle Knights fan?
No, mate. St. George supporter. My whole family is all the boys in the family. There's quite a. Isn't it funny? I was thinking about that. It's a traditional thing. We used to follow the same football team and the same, just say it was Forder Holden, wasn't it, for Mount Panorama?
Yeah.
For Bath. So I was a Ford man. Our family were Ford people. And all the men followed St. George, even from my father, with grandparents, all the way down to nieces, our nephews and everything. So, yeah. St. George.
Who were the Indigenous players for St. George that you remember?
Ricky Walford, I think, was a winger.
Oh, yep.
He was a good footballer. Chock. Yeah. Anthony Mundine, he's quite talented. And there's quite a few, mate. But I was a forward, so I don't even think they're actually classed as footballers if we're on a wing or...
Yeah, sure, right. Because so. I'm a Manly Seagulls fan.
Oh, I'm sorry for that. Apologies.
I often get that. But, of course, the great Cliffy Lyons.
What a player.
One of the greatest players of all time.
Yeah. And, I think he was out of Gomeroy. I think he was, I might be mistaken, but there's some good players out Moriway that come out. Yeah. Yeah, Gomeroy, Lades, Gomeroy, yeah. So played football down there. So some amazing, strong players.
Yeah, no, we could talk about rugby league all day, Dean, but I better get back on track. Yeah. What were the roles that you've had in mental health and suicide prevention before you established Healing Works Australia 3 years ago?
I started as a suicide prevention support coordinator for an aftercare program. So it was a program in the Murrumbidgee, and we did like three roles. And there's a lifespan model brought out by the Black Dog Institute, and Every Mind was bringing it out, and I did the Wayback Support Service with Beyond Blue. And it was an aftercare service, a support service for someone who had attempted suicide or had a suicide attempt for 12 weeks after suicide. So there's research around that's pretty dangerous time for someone that's had a suicide attempt to get practical supports and non-clinical supports while they but was clinically governed. So it was a pretty good program. And what we also did was three parts of the lifespan model, which is community active and community engagement, training in communities and stuff like that. So it was good. That's reference groups and community reference groups, and put up the governance up to the, up to chain. So it was really cool. It was a great learning curve for me.
And how has your own lived experiences influenced your move into this field?
So I was, like I said, I was in Newcastle working in business, and involved in a horrific incident that caused me quite significant physical and emotional injuries. And then from that, I had two suicide attempts off my own, and I ended up with complex PTSD or chronic hip, whatever they'd like to call it these days. I don't know. It's just trauma for me, and PTSD is quite horrific. And it's still with me. It's not part of me, but it's something that I live with. But at that time, I thought it was who I was. PTSD was quite a powerful thing. And I ended up having two suicide attempts and agoraphobia, however you pronounce so, which I wouldn't leave the bedroom for around 3 years.
Right.
And then I'm going to a treatment center, which was called Nuncurry Treatment Center, for my PTSD, my traumas, which is a treatment center up at Byron Bay, which is now called Byron Private Treatment Center. Yeah, and worked on my traumas to get me off the medications that were sort of holding me in that.
How did the treatment up there help you?
Well, how did it help? It helped in multifacets, because it was quite holistic. It also let me have a look at the trauma and past traumas, because PTSD just doesn't happen. It's trauma after trauma after trauma that builds up and up. And made me look at all those traumas together, made me look at family constellations, which is a lot of about generational traumas and what traumas I'm carrying from other people and what I need to not carry on as part of me, but part of my experience. So it was quite beautiful. And then all that self-loathing that you keep telling yourself and that dialogue narrative that you tell yourself that becomes sort of part of your being. And I remember I went up there, and one of the first sort of things we did was I was sitting there with one of the clinical directors there. And we had to sit, in a group setting, and then we did this sort of, we sat together, and I had to talk for 2 minutes, and she had to just listen and not respond, not nod, just sit and listen to me. And then after that, she said, you said PTSD 12 times in 2 minutes.
Right.
Yeah, because that was my world.
That was who you identified as.
That's what I identified as. And then that was a big shock, and that still sits with me back today. And then I went, really? 2 minutes? I sped PTSD 12 times because it was so ingrained in who I was. I used to wake up. I remember, Dean, I used to wake up and I had about 20 seconds of respite. That anxiety and pain and hurt wasn't there. And then you could feel that wave come up into my chest and sort of devour me. Then I was stuck in that for the rest of the day until I was medicated enough to fall asleep. And then it all started again the next day. Yeah, and it was quite empowering, quite devoured me, and I was filled with hatred, revenge and anger for a long time. And that sort of destroys who you are as a person. I forgot who I was. I had poor relationships with men. I couldn't even be in the same room as a man, Dean. And then so I went up there and I was, it's a beautiful experience. And I was mentored by men that I didn't even know it. I was just being with them, walking along the beach, sitting there having dinner with them, learning how to have relationships with people again. Yeah. So it was quite.
How did it help being in that physical environment up around Byron Bay? Like I'm assuming it was a really beautiful spiritual environment. How did that help you?
Yeah, it was. So part of what my traumas, I couldn't be around hospital settings or ambulances from the incident, yeah, because I was rushed to hospital in an ambulance, bang, in a hospital. It was quite traumatic. So I woke up in a hospital and that day was different. I woke up different. And I knew straight away I was not the same person. Woke up with fear, and I've never really wake up with fear before. It's hard to explain, that pressure and cloud that covers you. So I went up there, and it was like not a clinical setting. It was just like a resort in the bush. There was like only six residents allowed to be there at a time. We weren't allowed to have mobile phones. It was all vegetable-based eating, all organic. And we had our own chef. We did a lot of group therapy. We did art therapy, equine therapy, sound therapy. We'd go to the beach every day. It'd be on country. We'd sit in a yarning circle down on, there was a paddock there that would go down in the yarning circle and talk. We'd do our group therapies, and before it, they would play Indigenous music sung in language. And I just remember this, just sit and cry. It was a very connected experience. And there was this person there, Sarah, and I still dearly care for. We connected really closely, and I found out she was a Gomeroi person from Moree. And we just seemed to bond really well. And the first night I came in, so nervous, and I wouldn't come out of my room. And they said, come on, dinner. I wouldn't eat with people, Dean. So I went down there at this big table in this big hall. Beautiful. So when I say hall, it's not like a school setting. It's like gorgeous resort setting. And it's overlooking these beautiful hills and rainforest. And I'd eat my meal, and she'd get up and take my plate away. And she'd come back with some dessert, which was all fruit. And she really nurtured me. So I felt seen and heard by people, but it was because I had trauma. So they were guiding me on my journey because they'd been there. And these people had been in there a couple of weeks prior, I'll say. So they were ahead of the game in where I'm about to be in 2 weeks. So it was actually peer-to-peer supports happening in there. And I was guided by the clinical team that was in there. But it was the first time I've experienced peer-to-peer work from people experiencing trauma, guiding other people through trauma. It's quite beautiful. I'd never felt so accepted and heard in years, because people kept on saying, oh, I don't understand what you're going through. I can't understand. Like, and that was seen to isolate me more, where these people didn't even say anything, but they were guiding me. And how do you do that? Because you've been there. And it's not just saying, oh, I've done that too, or I've had this. No one said that. They were just guiding me.
It was just the most amazing experience.
It's just quite unique.
Wow, Dean, this is the model for treating trauma, isn't it?
Yeah, peer-to-peer. It's guiding from lived. Listen, lived experience is great, and there's a big push for that, and that's okay too, but you must have underpinning knowledge. And that's what they had at this, obviously, these treatment centers. Real good clinical governance, which now I work in mental health, I understand. I go, that's what they're doing. But I just thought it was like a holiday. Yeah, and I'm thinking, wow, this is crazy. But the growth I was having was so unique, but obviously clinically governed. And then I was put down to the non-clinical teams to articulate, disseminate what was going on. So beautiful work. And now I work in the framework. I'm like, it's so awesome to see. But because I experienced it, I think that's what guided me to where my journey was to be working in the field.
It's such an incredible experience, dude. And it just warms my heart to happen to hear you tell that story and to have had that journey that you've had. And now, like you say, you bring it to, and then Healing Works Australia gets established, and you can bring that experience to Healing Works Australia, right? So how does that inform the work that you do with Healing
Works? Yeah, I was going to ask before we go into that. Have you experienced something similar doing yourself? Because like we're a podcast, and I don't want you to just be asking me questions, brother. I want to have a yarn with you.
Sure. So. Well, this is why when you're sharing that story about your journey and your treatment, it was exactly the same for me in this psych ward in Melbourne. So there's a hospital setting, right? So very different to yours, a hospital setting. But that was my experience. But I was in there with my brother's veterans, first responders, and people who'd been through a lot of trauma, and with very experienced clinicians. And I went into that place thinking that I was alone. I went into that place thinking that no one knew what it was like to be me after all the trauma I'd experienced overseas as a journalist covering the war in Iraq and all these natural disasters in Asia and so on. And I went into this, and I'm getting goosebumps thinking about it right now.
No, I'm getting goosebumps from what you're talking. I'm getting these rushes over me, yeah.
Because these men and women in this place, they accepted me as one of their own. And I finally was able to get an insight into my trauma and learn the skills and understanding and be able to resume my life, because I was very suicidal before I went to Ward 17 back in 2016. And it was that first psych ward admission. I ended up having three over 3 years. It was that first psych ward admission that turned my life around. And that clinical setting worked well for me. Doesn't work well for everyone. Everyone's got to find their own, I guess, what works for them. You found yours. I found mine.
Yeah.
And here we are now chatting. So.
Yeah. And while you're talking, I'm thinking possibly because you were in the armed forces and all that.
Struggle. Journalist.
Yeah.
But had a lot of experience with soldiers and so on. Yeah.
Yeah. So that experience of that structure is probably really good for you in that hospital setting where, with my sort of background and stuff, I think that more natural sort of guidance fitted more for who I was. And as you were talking, I'm thinking, and you said I felt accepted. I think we actually started to get our identity back, because identity is part of where you feel you belong and where you feel you fit in. And so I believe that's where I started to get my identity back. I went, oh, I belong here. I belong with these sort of people. I belong, and I'm just all gorgeous, all different walks of life, but just such beautiful souls and spirits. And, It started to bring me alive again.
Well, it's one of the things I was going to ask you a bit later, Dean, but I'll ask you right now, because we talked about this recently, right? For First Nations people, hospital settings are not good, are they?
No.
Mental health wards are not good. They are not good places. Can you just talk a bit about that in this context?
Look, we have poor outcomes when it comes to hospital settings, and I know it myself, so it's not an ideal place. Like historically, it's probably somewhere where we're known as an Indigenous person, you go to die if you're very unwell. A lot of our people don't go back. Yeah, so, and there's also a study in 2021. I'm going to backtrack and give you some context. I worked in an aftercare program that was in a clinical toxicology team in Newcastle, New South Wales. And there was a paper released, and I'm on the paper with Dr. Katie McGill and some other great researchers, and Professor Phil Carter, and Indigenous cultural identity, likelihood of discharge, psychiatric hospital after deliberate self-poisoning, and 21. And the conclusion was that Indigenous cohort had a lower likelihood to be in psychiatric care or discharged to psychiatric care from admission to an ED. And even with adjustments to the variables, there was just a 33% discrepancy. We would normally, our Indigenous people get just labeled with, oh, it's drug and alcohol, or it's because they're violent. And we get we don't get a discharge to a psychiatric ward. We just get discharged to community. Right. So when I'm talking ED, then you get discharged or an admin to a mental health unit. And there was about eight of them there at different sections.
just doesn't happen. Like 33.
The study is showing that First Nations people are basically being judged as alcoholics or drug addicts as opposed to requiring mental health care.
Yeah, yeah. And it says that highlighted for a need for further investigation and the reasons accounting for differential patterns on clinical treatment and management of our people. And it just says in the paper, systematic racism, they believe what it is. And this was done over 10 years, Dean. So this study, and they kept changing the variables associated for the discharge in the study to see if they could get a better outcome. Couldn't get a better outcome.
Right. So what can be done to change this, Dean? What are the sort of, what has to happen to change this?
Well, we just, if you go to a hospital, there's not, you've got to have some understanding of our cultural considerations and what we need as Indigenous people and what social emotional wellbeing means for us. And there's different broad range of factors that impact our mental health and what healing looks like for us is quite different for a lot of different people. So, you know, there's things that we require as Indigenous people. We need a connection to culture, country and the community because it's such rich, diverse, what that means. We need strong family relationships. Families play a very strong part in our Indigenous community. So when we go to a hospital setting, our families need to be involved within decision-making or even in the room where that's smallly prioritised on an individual basis. And we don't get that family connection or they're not even allowed in the room to have discussions with the clinical teams. We need to be discussing more positive parenting practices and what that looks like within the hospital settings. Education in the hospital settings around Indigenous needs and well-being and being more cultural safe, like even like some artwork or people. I find it different there. So if you go to a pediatric ward, they're all wearing scrubs with cartoons on it and teddy bears and everything. So you can make that safe and visually safe for children. But in an ED, you can't have an Indigenous collar or Indigenous shirt or a symbol on it for the staff. They're all just blanketed. Now, if you have a safe-looking place for our Indigenous people, or even a shirt, it shows me straight away that you're a safe place to be. So they've got those considerations for youth. Why can't they have them simply in an EDC?
It seems like a very simple thing that could be done.
No, but the thing is, it's thoughts to do for youth and what youth need to see a safe environment. Because it's a visual thing, Dean. If you look at a visual thing straight away, our people will walk in a room and we'll see if there's if there's any artwork. That's why people try to put artwork and acknowledgements of country. They're all the visual cues that this is a safe place for us. Now, a lot of hospital settings are so white walls. It's almost, it is institutional. And if you look at what institutions look for our people, it's not a great way. And straight away, we have that trauma and connection to a poor outcome.
Right.
Mm.
Dean, when you're talking about youth, and I just want to, there's some shocking statistics around suicide, and the suicide rate for First Nations people is nearly 2.5 times that of non-Indigenous people in Australia. And it's, I find this just horrifying that the rate of suicide of our young Indigenous men is the highest in the world, according to a 2016 report. I know the answer is not simple, but why are these numbers?
This is a very complex question. So we've got multi-layers, and I can talk about like historical ongoing trauma. Aboriginal men experience a history of trauma, dispossession of land. We have higher incarceration rates. I think it's around 28% in New South Wales incarceration rates for Indigenous men, people. And we've got a 2.9 percentage rate. It's probably 3 in New South Wales. So that's 10 times.
3% of the population.
Yeah, 3% of the population in New South Wales, but we're 28% of people incarcerated. Crazy. Like, I know we're deadly, brother, but we're not, you know, but come on. So, but what's that look like? Well, it starts from the youth coming up, and we such a big cycle, Dean, so we don't have men in the family, there's research showing that any children going up with a male in a one-parent single family with a female has a higher rates of being within the law, as a higher rates of doing all sorts of activities that don't go well within communities. Most of the people that shoot up these schools over in America are single parent families which don't have fathers in these relationships. So there's guidance that need by what a male and a female need within the family structure. We come up through school and a young Aboriginal boy will get a different treatment in a school with the same behavior as a young Indigenous female. Like a young six-year-old boy that's showing obvious signs of trauma within his behaviours will be suspended or said that he's has poor behaviours, where the female given a better outcome through her emotional supports. About 50% of our Indigenous males don't get to Year 10 or high school, so we have poor literacy and outcomes through there. We'll have more people go to a detention centre at youth than they'll go get through high school or Year 12. So if you look at those rates, and then they ended up going into prison, so that our pathway and our meaningful education and pathways through employment are quite different to non-Indigenous people in this country. So it's a big circle, yeah? So then there's what those outcomes and our role for an Aboriginal man is in a family, in a community is quite different to thousands of years ago, where our roles and our identities have been stripped. And then we've got all those factors and we start getting involved in law enforcement and in the court system quite young. And then it goes from there. It almost becomes a rite of passage in some communities that you must go to be part of the corrections with our people, because that's the narrative that's been told to us in the dialogue and it's our own voices. So I'd like to see a switch back to our strengths of our cultural, and it's coming along very nicely within these communities. We've got these great organisations and the researchers and amazing things happening in Kimberley and Cairns and some great organisations, and Aunt Pat Dudgeon with her social emotional wellbeing framework. That works quite well, and it's getting through all these Aboriginal community controlled health organisations for these social and emotional wellbeing programs, and quite culturally strong. And it's a beautiful place for me to be working within. That's where we're based currently.
Yeah, talk more about those strengths, Dean. Elaborate on that a little bit more, and then talk more about what Healing Works Australia does as well. What you're playing.
Well, the thing is, we've got such a rich culture of our own laws and our, which go back to respecting elders and just all those main basic, well, I look at them as basic principles what I grew up with, that of lessons are taught to you along the way. We've got a big connection to our country, what that means to us, big connection to our culture. And that's not just, dancing and sort of didgeridoos and, those artifacts. Our culture is multifaceted, and we've got our laws and our lessons and what we can do. And if it goes back to when you look right into it, and totems and where our connections are to our family and skin colors, can marry certain different skin colors when it goes back. So there's so many different layers of what our culture is and what that means to our identity. So I live off country, but I go to every town I go to, Dean, I go straight to the land council and announce that I'm on country. I'm an Indigenous man off country. I'm here to do talk on your country about certain topics. And then they say, yep, that's beautiful. Go here, go here, go there. But you're endorsed or from the people working in the land council to be on country. These are very simple practices that we come down from generations being taught. And that's what used to happen to our people. Didn't really have borders. It might be tree or this, but would come in there and they have a spotter. Come out and say, ask what you're doing, and what. And then the other person would say, we're here for this, and we do trades or whatever our business was. So we still do that today. We follow those principles within our Indigenous communities, and it's recognised how we do our reciprocity and what we do for our communities and people. It's just a different mindset from people that don't have that similar cultural background. And culture is very, I can't sit and talk about culture because that's different for every community and person. And I'm on my own cultural journey for that, for what that means to me. And I have people that take me out bush and we practice culture and law. And I'm actually, as we speak, I'm doing a week cultural diet with a group of men that we're going back to eating traditionally for a week and what that means to us. And that spiritual things coming to us and those cravings from what we have in our bodies and sort of the detox. And we sit with these men and we talk about a lot of culture and what it is to be eating these foods and what it means to us. It's quite a beautiful experience. These are still our practices that we can still do in a Western world that we live in. Yeah, we have to be able to live in a black and white world. Yeah. But I believe we live in a Western world, Dean. And I live with beautiful people in Australia at the moment. But I can still practice our culture with our people in our cultures. Just like you practice karate or someone might practice their religion, we practice culture.
Yeah, one of the things, and that's interesting, you really highlight the uniqueness of each community, and especially in the work that you're doing, you put a lot of emphasis on recognizing that each community is unique, and that when you're going into communities to do your workshops on suicide awareness and training, that that each community needs to be consulted and actively involved. Can you just talk a little bit about why that is the case?
Yeah, of course. So, look, our workshops are different in each community, and we recognize that communities are unique. And we sit here and we help with the listening and co-design of what their community may need within whatever traumas or what they're experiencing. And that might look like sitting in there a few times and having yarns. And then we help to even articulate the question that they're trying to pose. Does that make sense? Like,
yep.
We don't give them say, this is what you need. We actually help them with the yarning and say, well, actually, this is what you guys are trying to achieve, is it? And they go, yeah, that's what we're trying to achieve. And then we come back and go, well, do you think this might fit within your community? And do you think this might help? And then they can either say, yeah, no, or beautiful, or we bring in other great organizations and people within us where we partnership and kinship with. So that's sort of how healing works, because I can't go into a community. So we just went up to all the mid-coast and doing some work in the communities and asking on what the impacts from the bushfire have been, and which, of course, now we've had the floods, so I can't go in and go, hey, we've got this. Do you need it? Well, hang on, they mightn't even want that sort of thing. They mightn't even be ready for a team. The trauma might be so raw, or they're trying to people are so exhausted at the moment, and they don't even know what they're trying to do. They're just trying to survive, trying to find a roof over their heads and trying to find a meal. So just hearing what's going on, and they're getting them to ask help to see if they're to articulate the questions to their own needs. That sounds probably weird for some people. So what do you mean articulate the questions that they're trying to ask? But, well, that's what you do when you listen to communities and people. You go, well, I'm sensing this. Is this what's happening for you? And then is this what we're trying to say? And then we go from there.
No, it makes complete sense to me. What you're saying is you're not going into communities and trying to impose solutions.
No, we can't. See, they, yes, the communities and our people really have the answers to their own solutions. And that's self-determination. They really do. We're just trying to help them, and we can then recognize people in the community that may have been here before, and I've established this, and the traditional owners, and we get everybody involved so that they've actually got a bit of impact to what's happening in the community, and we're all got their little piece of the pie. And then, we connect with all different stakeholders. So it's not working in silo like predominantly a lot of people do, because we're funding streams and all this sort of structure. So we just connect people together, which all have their little bits of funding streams, and bring them all together. We're getting a lot of communities and organizations going, wow, this is amazing. Exactly what we're trying to do, because we've all got fundings for different parts. And we bring them in, it's almost like coordinating the needs of community, but the community is telling us what the needs are. And then sometimes that takes a lot of time. It can take up to 4 to 5 months just to get accepted and talk to the traditional owners and be endorsed to work on country, and then get to the right people, because everyone's got their own agenda, Dean, and what they're trying to achieve, but making it more of an agenda for everyone. And how they do that can be quite complicated, and I've got some amazing people in our team can help with that. So yeah,
I just want to, you mentioned you're doing this the work on the north coast of New South Wales, and you've been spending a lot of time up there with Indigenous communities affected by the bushfires, and more recently the flood. Can you just talk me through what the impact of these natural disasters have had on First Nations communities
in the areas? It's been quite significant. So the Black Summer bushfires have caused significant distress for Aboriginal people, generating urgency to address the mental health needs in communities in a cultural appropriate way. This devastation of country has disrupted connections and ingrained in Indigenous people's social emotional well-being. Connections to community, family, culture amid the global pandemic, even. An inability to travel to attend important events, including funerals and cultural celebrations, Dean, it's quite been hard on our communities. You can imagine, and it happened to a lot of families, but we have these cultural protocols that would come with the death and sorry business. a lot of people had people die in Queensland but couldn't get to funerals, and they're trying to Zoom and a cultural funeral over Zoom. It has impacts on everybody, but it's we have these cultural protocols. So you've got to have an understanding of cultural considerations to what that experience means for those people. Same experience doesn't mean the same for everybody, and that might be someone losing their job in COVID to be, we're going to have to go to the office, where someone had that connection to that job for 30 years and it was part of their highest of identity, it has a different impact. So the same works for people that die and their families and culture and what sorry business is. So I'm just giving you a bit of an understanding of what differences are. So bushfires have further impacted many Aboriginal people in seeing the land in distress, experience grief and loss from destruction of cultural sites, and then witnessing the impact of mismanagement of the land. You know, and this was a research done in 2020, that and the qualitative research and the impacts of bushfires, people has found that the bushfires felt like a colonization all over again, basically. And they re-traumatization through loss of land and loss of sacred trees, perpetuated from ongoing issues with Aboriginal people's voices unheard. And with that mismanagement of the land, and our people have been trying to say for years how to do this, and then Parliament saying, no, we don't want to slash trees, we don't want to do this, and bang. And then those impact our people differently to other people. So it's quite stressful.
Has this opened the way the scale of these disasters have just been
horrific. Yeah, for all people.
Yeah. Has this opened the way for First Nations expertise, do you think, to at least have more of a say in
what I believe it is
done with the management of land and just dealing with bushfires, dealing with floods?
Yeah, it has. And I've seen reports after that from the bushfires and the recommendations. There's great recommendations to have more consultation and input from Indigenous people of those communities for the management of the land. So this, it had an impact, but it's been a positive impact for people to understand that let's get Indigenous people's knowledge involved, and let's accept that their knowledge is gold standard for the full land management. It's not, that's just what they did 10,000 years ago. So, yeah. And we acknowledge within Healing Works that a lot of people and first responders and families that have been living on these lands for hundreds of years on their farms are just as impacted. So we're mindful the non-Indigenous people that are farming on those lands are. That, imagine generations of a farm that your family's built up and then it gets burnt to the ground and all your animals and, your sheep and your cattle that you've bred to get that exact breeding and those agricultural lands for them is wiped away for 4 generations. So we're still mindful of that within Healing Works Australia, that it impacts everybody on a different scale. And we've got to be mindful when we're supporting Indigenous communities that we're still thinking of first responders, because those first responders' families might have worked that land for 4 generations and the impact it has on them. But so it's a very holistic view of acceptance and understanding that everybody's impacted on a different scale for the same event will mean something different to someone else. And that's where suicide prevention comes in with this. So an understanding of what I feel about something, you will feel something different and it'll impact you differently. So I have just a mindful of that.
Yeah, no, absolutely, Dean. Just on the suicide prevention, I'm really curious when it comes to the sort of your approach to teaching these skills, suicide intervention skills.
Mm.
When you go out into communities and the workshops, what sort of language are you using? How direct are you when you're...
Very.
Great. Okay. Yeah, tell me about that.
Very direct. So if you're asking if we talk about suicide and killing yourself, we use this direct language. And then we build up on this and we talk about what that means to people and why we have those barriers. And it's quite nice to have these conversations and people go, because it's confronting if I say to you, Dean, are you thinking about killing yourself, Dean? Mm. Those words alone will think you go to, killing yourself? No, I'm just having trouble with, I don't know what to do, or I'm having trouble with the family or with money. So what it does, it helps you have dialogue to fix your own problems. Because if I say you're thinking about killing yourself, well, you're not really thinking about dying, having trouble living. So it actually helps articulate, put things on the spot and spark in a a real conversation about, is this thinking, is this about killing yourself? What suicide means to you? I like to ask that question. Yeah. What suicide means to you? And a lot of people say, I'm just overwhelmed. I don't know what to do. I've lost them and their relationship. So that gives me the background straight away of what's going on. It's not about dying. It's about having trouble living with the things at the moment. So asking directly, brother, is a great way to doing it. It's getting right.
You find this works with men especially?
100%. Yep. And youth. Dean, like if you talk suicide to a 12-year-old, 10-year-old, they probably don't know what you're talking about.
Right.
You're talking about killing yourself. They know what, mate, they're playing those games and that. I remember at 6 playing cops and robbers and cowboys and Indians, I knew what killing someone meant.
Yep.
Yep. Suicide, ask me at 7 what suicide was. I wouldn't even have a clue. I think back now, and I remember a 14-year-old boy finding that person. No, he killed himself. Didn't know whether he suicide. And I think back there now, I work in suicide prevention, and sometimes it takes a lot to go back and explain it like I'm 6. Because we get so into our language and our knowledge systems, and we do it every day, but we've got to explain it to you like I'm a 6-year-old.
Yeah.
But you ever got directions from a local dean? In a town, they go, oh, you go down the street, go past Bluey's.
Yeah.
Around the corner and you'll see this black stump there. Just go down that, then you'll see a blue letterbox.
It makes sense.
Makes sense to them.
Yeah.
But to me, I'm like, what are you talking about? Yeah. So we've got to do the same thing when we're trying to articulate this to communities and the people. Does that within suicide and emotional wellbeing?
But I agree totally. You got to use very straight language.
Straight away.
There's no point mucking around with the issue.
Yeah. And when we do talk about straight away and direct language, it brings up those conversations where people are uncomfortable about. And what that does, it gives them a platform to have these conversations, why they feel they can't do it. Why? What are the barriers? What are their belief systems? What are their attitudes around and experiences around suicide? What might be stopping them from having that direct conversation? And it's predominantly about their own need. I need to not make someone upset. I need to make sure that if I say something, they won't kill themselves. I need to feel comfortable. Yeah. But what we learn is to do a task to someone else's need when we're doing these things. So when we ask these questions, it'd be cool. It comes around, but it's more about our own fears, stigmas around the subject, not about the actual thing itself.
Yeah. Dean, I'm really curious about trauma for a non-Indigenous person. Like myself, and I talk to a lot of journalists about trauma, and I talk about how it might be a specific event that they've experienced, or usually it's an accumulation of experiences. Same with first responders, that sort of thing. What does the word trauma mean for your community, if I can ask that question?
With our historic and ongoing traumas, it's got a lot of depossession of land, culture, and language. Forced removal of families and discrimination, Dean, it sits at the core of that. And then, so that trauma is so deep, every time we experience something, that if we get that feeling, we connect it straight to one of those trauma events, just like everybody does with trauma. So therefore, something's happening and within a group of people, and I'm maybe the only Indigenous person in the room or the organization, and those feelings come up, I will connect it straight to discrimination. So sometimes without work done and without going through trauma work, we project that discrimination might be happening when it might even not be.
Yeah.
So we've got to be mindful of that of Indigenous people, that we are so strong, and it's only 240 years ago. So it's not that far when we look at other communities or that have been colonized, there are thousands of years.
Yeah.
Like that's a drop in the ocean. So we really connect to those disadvantages and those traumas. It's only like 4 or 5 generations.
Yeah.
Like my sisters and that growing up, we weren't even classed as fauna, as people, fauna and flora. So that's been, so you're thinking about, we're here shaking our heads at that, but it's hard to believe. Okay. And look, my sisters and brothers, if they went to a class and a non-Indigenous person, our family didn't want that Aboriginal boy into that class, they'd just be removed and taken out of school.
out of that little will of a non-Indigenous person.
So you got to remember, and we talk about what's the impacts of Indigenous people not getting educated. It's our grandparents' attitudes to what the school system was. So I have experienced a different life to my parents and grandparents. My daughter, thankfully, hasn't had the same experiences that I've had. And it's just generations that have changed. We're having a better outcomes and better outcomes. But I've got to be mindful when I'm sitting in a room talking about these things and I've got elders or younger people, they've experienced a totally different world within the same place. And I'll give you an example of that. It's like saying, why is Johnny, who is 12, such a bad boy when his sister, the 7, is such a beautiful little girl and they got the same parents? Well, they don't have the same parents, do you? Because they're not, they're socially impacted differently, they're economically impacted differently. The 12-year-old Johnny had younger parents probably going through a harder life than the little sister has, where dad's probably got a better job and mum's more secure in the family unit. And the second child is easier because they know what they're doing. So there's totally different impacts, even in a family structure, to say you do not have the same parents as your siblings do. Now, you think about that for a minute, you go, oh, I don't actually, do I? So I don't have the same experience as my brothers and sisters do. I don't have the same parents they did. I don't have the same teachers, and I don't experience the same things that my parents did. And my daughter never experienced what I did at school, thankfully.
Yeah. So what you're saying, this is really interesting, Dean, because whenever people ask me to talk about my experiences in Iraq, they always say, are you okay to talk about this? Is this going to re-traumatize you? And so on. And I say, no, I'm fine, I'm fine. I've dealt with all that. But for First Nations people, there can be so many different ways that you can be, that there could be re-traumatizing events.
On a daily basis.
But on a daily basis. Ask you that question. Does anyone ever say to you, is this re-traumatizing for you? Is this making you feel uncomfortable? Does anyone ever say that?
In other stakeholders or in my own team?
Just in general. Indigenous people ever say to you, does this make you feel uncomfortable?
Yes. And I'll say to you, I'm surrounded by some of the beautiful people. And I work closely with Dr. Joe Tai, who's an Irishman that's working with our people for decades. He'll ask me and he works with me on a professional level. I've got other people that worked with our people, they're non-Indigenous, but three to four decades up the Kimberley and stuff, that work closely with Nacho and Close the Gap. They ask me, but because they're aware of what that might mean to me. But no, normally people don't. What we're finding, Dean, is with our Aboriginal workers working in Aboriginal health, there's no setup for them to get support clinically or cultural support around what that might be. And when I say cultural supervision, I'm not talking about, this is your cultural belief systems. No, the barriers to our cultural perspectives when we're working in health systems, what Aboriginal health means, like a holistic setting for us, and then in the Western model, the differences and how we can bring them together, the barriers to see what our holistic health settings, the benefits of it, and that it's recognized as what we need for people, because it can be just like scoffed at by clinical teams in hospital settings. Oh, whatever, that's not, see, they even have an understanding of what that means to an Indigenous worker to have that impact when we're trying to work in our communities, that it's not recognized as best practice by clinical, non-cultural clinical teams, what that can have to your own psyche. This is what Healing Works is working closely with some archos at the moment, with their cultural clinical supervision. We've been asked by some wonderful Aboriginal community-controlled health organizations out west, in Dubbo and Canamble and Gilgandra, putting on new staff members, us to mentor the staff from the start through their, you know, we get their position descriptions, look what they're trying to achieve, get the Healing Works team involved in mentoring them from day one through what that looks like in cultural and clinical supervision along the way. Just gives them a beautiful platform to be able to achieve great things and then get the pathway to employment strategies from day one. So it's being recognized more. We've been asked by the peak bodies in Perth to look at doing that for 12 sites as well, and other organizations as well, like
not in the health system, have come to Healing Works lately to say, hey, we want to talk to you about how we can support our teams through the ongoing. We had the Black Lives Matter, and then we got the Voice, and we had bushfires and the floods, and they've got to go out and service the communities, even not in health, even in other businesses, the impacts it's having on them. How can you come and have a yarn to us about how we can support our teams? So that's, it's becoming more prominently knowledge of how we need to understand the impacts on a day-to-day basis that our Indigenous workers have working in any framework. As the Voice we're talking about for communities, we've experienced the same discrimination, depossession of families, and culture and forced removal in stolen generations. So I wasn't, you know, I'm not immune to any of that, but I've got to work in that same framework, so it does impact.
So how do you cope, Dean? What are your, I mean, you, I'm looking at you and you look like a very resilient man, but how do you cope? What are your coping strategies?
My coping strategies. I've got a lot of coping strategies, and I've got a lot of, this is the beautiful thing about, so when I was very unwell, I was working in retail, and I was running teams of 30 and leading teams. That got all stripped. I couldn't get back to there. And I was in a new town, which I hadn't rooted in my connections to community. I was off country, straight into business, and I'd go there and come home 7 days a week. So I had no connections to community. So when that identity of working in that role was taken, and my identity of being a partner and everything sort of diminished because of injuries and emotional well-being, I had no other identities. So I had no other strengths. I had no connections to my country. I was off country. Culture, I wasn't practicing culture. I wasn't connected to community. I didn't have a purpose anymore because I wasn't doing that role. So when we strip off those layers of what identity is, you know, a team member, part of the footy, I used to do martial arts. I couldn't go there anymore. Yeah, so they were taken. That can make you very vulnerable and unwell. But now I've got connections to community. I'm connected in my local community. I go to sporting teams. I go to a gym. At the moment, I'm connected with men that we're doing cultural diet. So back to traditional foods and practicing culture and law, you know, for a time being. So everything I eat and drink is going to be only native, doing that sort of thing. So that connects me back to that as well in my day-to-day lives. I'm on advisory groups for Indigenous people. I'm a member of Coalition Peaks. So those identities are put on me by community. So our identities are negotiation with communities, not something I impose on someone. I can't walk on up and say, oh, I'm an Indigenous leader and I want to be part of this. No, that has to be appointed to me in our cultural practices. And that's what builds you those strengths as we are. Makes me stronger because I have multi-layers of who Dean is at the moment. And plus I do ice baths and a meditation of the morning. Every morning at the same time, I'll hop in an ice bath for a certain amount of time. It's amazing. I actually crave it, Dean. I remember the second day I did it, big ice chunks floating around me, and I've got a thermometer, it just says zero. And I sat in there.
This is a throwback to your rugby league days, right? When you were a prop forward, trying to get over the injury.
Well, yeah. So I just hop in there and it just forces you to, it's just shock. The body just goes in shock. And then all of a sudden you start to breathe softer and softer until you almost stop breathing. You're just sitting there, no need to breathe. And then my mind is just still. There's just no noise. And I can hear birds. I can hear the plane flying over. I can feel the burning sensation on my legs. And I go, oh, what is that burning? Where is it in my body? And it's just this most beautiful moment. And then I think, oh, I've only been in here about 30 seconds and the alarm will go off for 3 minutes or 5 minutes. It's just this surreal happiness. And the second day I did it, I hopped out and started crying. I was just so... Really? I experienced this before when I had my first clinic, cultural supervision, I remember it. So I had this experience again. I've had this three times predominantly in my life where I've had such a beautiful experience that I've cried after it, cries of joy and fulfillment. And one of them was when I had PTSD and someone gave me a meditation app to listen to, and it was taking me through mindfulness to be at a river, imagine myself here and imagine the
praying mantis doing this and the dragonfly flying over. I could do that. And I started crying that day. I wasn't thinking of everything else. Cultural supervision, the very first day I had cultural supervision, I remember hopping in my car and crying because I felt so empowered and full of a gift that someone gave me with my culture. And then, well, not my culture, but guidance through working through in my framework, within the cultural framework. And then it was with this ice bath more recently when I hopped out. It was just my mind was still. I felt things in my body where trauma was trapped. So I felt it's just this most amazing.
Sounds like it was, you had some sort of release, almost like catharsis.
Just
like release.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's just quite beautiful. And because you've got this breathing and trauma and you're feeling this, and then it was like zoom, just sucked into, I was just in there, sitting there. Still, nothing. It was nothingness.
Wow.
It's gorgeous.
It's a beautiful experience in the morning. And then I crave it the next morning. I'm like, I'm going to get up, get outside.
I don't know. I'm not sure I could do the ice baths. Dean, what I've done occasionally is I like going into the rainforest here in Tasmania, which is
gorgeous
part of the world. And I'll occasionally get in one of the rivers there, which is a beautiful experience.
Dean, you live in an ice bath. You're in Tasmania, mate.
Yeah, I know. That is true. That is true.
Tasmania is a knife bar.
Yes. You sound like you've got a lot of purpose in life, a lot of meaning in life. What does the future hold for you? What is it you still want to do?
Purpose in life is this. It's just in serving. And I think as we get older, Dean, and yourself, we get more of I out of the conversations and more community. It's more, I don't have the answers, but I won't stop searching the question why and how the community and what the community needs and how I can maybe be able to link in with people to support them. So, yeah, I have purpose. My purpose is to continually work in a social emotional wellbeing framework with these amazing leaders that have been building for decades. So, like, we've got our Aunt Pat Dudgeons and all these beautiful people that have worked for decades to get the doors open for them, and they left it open for people like me to come through. And so I'm like a tadpole in knowledge compared to these people. So I'm just thankful for those who are guiding me through my journey, and then I can guide others. You got Pat Turner and all these beautiful people that have done all this amazing work. So I'm just thankful that I can sit on some advisory teams with these people in the Coalition of Peaks, my own policy partnerships with these people for social emotional well-being for the next 3 years to close the gap. So that's such a unique experience. They're such beautiful minds and amazing strength within those groups and what their visions are and where they've been and where we look to be. It's just gives me so much drive and hope, and I can see where the strategies are going. So I'm just quite excited. That's just such a privilege for me. I call it black privilege. Yeah, we all talk about white privilege and that. I've got black privilege, my brother. I'm a guy that went to year 9, failed year 10, and plenty of people like me. But I've got such good mentors that have guided me, and I've taken that knowledge and gone to the next level. And I'm on this Coalition of Peaks Policy Partnership. I'm on a lot of national advisory groups. Black privilege, my friend, and I'm privileged, and I take that privilege quite seriously for what that means. I rely on my integrity, and so do my community. So that privilege I don't take lightly, and I don't take that privilege for my own gain, which I think when people get privilege, it can happen. So I take it quite seriously, and I have people relying on that privilege I have to make sure we try to get outcomes.
Dean, it's just been brilliant talking to you. It's been an absolute joy, and I don't often say that when I do these podcasts or conversations, but it really has been a joy for me to chat with you. And one thing I just want to say, and because I didn't do this at the start, but I've learned from this conversation, was that I needed to acknowledge that I was speaking to you from Lutruwita, land of the Pahlawa people. I was going to put it in the introduction for Sive to do, our friend Sive, but I should have done it right at the start and said it. So I just want to make that acknowledgement to you right now at the end.
Yeah, thank you. And Dean, I just want to acknowledge, when I do my acknowledgement, that's for me and my spirit, my old people, because I do it all the time. And some non-Indigenous people can go, oh, shit, I didn't do that. No, please don't feel, brother, you're a true follower. And the fact that you're sitting and you care so much for our communities and you do so much beautiful work for trauma and PTSD, for return servicemen, for people with veterans and for people that work in, the framework
on this.
Yeah, mate, you do. Listen, you're a true follower. So when I acknowledge the traditional owners on land, it's just I have to do that for my old people and the land I'm on. It's just a cultural practice that I do. And it's just me acknowledging that where I am and I'm off country.
Gotcha.
But I acknowledge and thank you that you said that as well.
Yeah. No, I think we all, as we go through our journeys in life, and having lived overseas for 20 years, there's not a lot you can learn about other people and you just don't know. And it's good to always be mindful of that, right? So,
Dean, for me, this is our first look. I can't wait to, this is the first of many talks I think you and I will have. I want to hear more about what you do and your training, and you go in and you teach people about mental health at workplaces and stuff. I want to have a look at your workshops. I want a signed copy of that book when it comes out.
Got it.
And
I want to come and see you when I'm in New South Wales. I really look forward to sitting down.
We're going to
give you a big hug.
No, we're going to make this happen, my brother. And I'm going to sit down, I'm going to have a coffee, walk along the beach and feel the sun on our face and just be happy that the trauma we've gone through has guided us to be able to have a purpose and help others with their own journey.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, Dean. It's been wonderful to talk to you. Thanks for your time.
Thanks, brother.
The Mindarma podcast shares stories of personal resilience and mental health. If you are impacted by any of the stories shared in the podcast, please consider reaching out for support. In Australia, you may choose to call Lifeline on 13 11 14. If you are living outside of Australia, please visit befrienders.org for support services in your country.
Thank you for joining us on the Mindarma podcast. We invite you to discover even more with the Mindarma e-learning program. Mindarma is an award-winning program being used by thousands of workers as they take on some of the world's most challenging roles. Learn more about your brain, unwind with relaxing guided mindfulness exercises, and discover simple, practical skills you can use whenever the going gets tough. Find out more at mindarma.com. Purchase online, or better still, ask your boss about bringing Mindarma into your workplace.